The Wake Up Call with Richard Martin, Mondays and Fridays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. The opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Richard Martin at the Wake Up Call, coming to you live from Singapore on Monday, May the 9th, 2011. Well, as I've always said, I shall restrict this show to the whys and wherefores of the financial and economic world, and I shall so do, but I'm sorely tempted to give my opinion on other matters relating to our friend Osama bin Laden, but that will have to wait for another lifetime. Anyway, the True Finn Party, that you may have heard about, it was in fact a fairly off-the-grid party in Finland, but having made a solemn promise to oppose the so-called bailouts of Eurozone member states, was catapulted to power recently in the elections, and I would like to relate to you part of what their leader, Timo Soini, had to say in a really excellent article published this very day in the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, "These bailouts are patently bad for Europe, bad for Finland, and bad for the countries that have been forced to accept them. Europe is suffering from the economic gangrene of insolvency, both public and private. The official wisdom is that Greece, Ireland, and Portugal have been hit by a liquidity crisis, so they needed a momentary infusion of capital, after which everything would return to normal. But this official version is a lie, one that takes the ordinary people of Europe for idiots. They deserve better from politics and their leaders. To understand the real nature and purpose of the bailouts, we first have to understand who really benefits from them. Let's follow the money. At the risk of being accused of populism, let's begin with the obvious. It is not the little guy that benefits. He is being milked and lied to in order to keep the insolvent system running. He is paid less and taxed more to provide the money needed to keep this Ponzi scheme going. Meanwhile, a kind of deadly symbiosis has developed between politicians and banks. The political leaders borrow ever more money to pay off the banks, which return the favor by lending ever more money back to the governments, keeping the scheme afloat. In a true market economy, bad choices get penalized. Not here. When the inevitable failure of over-indebted Eurozone countries came to light, a secret pact was made. Instead of accepting losses on unsound investments, which would have led to the probable collapse and national bailout of some banks, it was decided to transfer the losses to taxpayers via loans, guarantees, and opaque constructs such as the European Financial Stability Fund, Ireland's NAMA, and a lineup of special purpose vehicles that make Enron look simple. Some politicians understood this. Others just panicked and did as they were told. The money did not go to help indebted economies. It flowed through the European Central Bank and recipient states to the coffers of big banks and investment funds. Further, contrary to the official wisdom, the recipient states did not want such so-called help, not this way. The natural option for them was to admit insolvency and let failed private lenders, wherever they were based, eat their losses. That was not to be. As former Finance Minister Brian Lenihan recently revealed, Ireland was forced to take the money. The same happened to Portuguese Prime Minister José Sócrates, although he will be less forthcoming than Mr. Lenihan about admitting it. Why did the Brussels-Frankfurt extortion racket force these countries to accept the money along with recovery plans that would inevitably fail? Because they needed to please the tax-guzzling banks, which might otherwise refuse to turn up at the next Spanish, Belgian, Italian, or even French bond auction. Unfortunately for this financial and political cartel, their plan isn't working. Already under this scheme, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal are ruined. They will never be able to save and grow fast enough to pay back the debts with which Brussels has saddled them in the name of saving them. And so, unpurged, the gangrene spreads. The Spanish property sector is much bigger and more uncharted than that of Ireland. It is not just the cars that are in trouble. There are major Spanish banks where what lies beneath the surface of the balance sheet may be a zombie, just as happened in Ireland for a while. The clock is ticking, and the problem is not going away. Setting up the European Stability Mechanism is no solution. It institutionalized the system of wealth transfers from private citizens to compromised politicians and otherwise failed bankers, creating a huge moral hazard and destroying what remains of Europe's competitive banking landscape. Some defend the ESM, saying its use would always require unanimity. But the current mess with Portugal shows that the elite in Brussels will seek to enforce unanimity through pressure when it cannot be obtained by persuasion. Abolishing unanimity is only a matter of time. After that, we have a full-fledged fiscal transfer union that is obviously in hock to Brussels' anti-growth corporatism. This is not just about economics. People feel betrayed. In Ireland, the incoming parties to the new government promised to hold senior bondholders responsible, but under pressure, they succumbed, leaving their voters with a sense of democratic disenfranchisement. The elites in Brussels have said that Finland must honour its commitments to its European partners. Brussels is silent on whether national politicians should honour their commitment to their own voters. In a democracy where we govern under the consent of the people, power is on loan. We do what we promise, even if it costs a dinner in Brussels, a negative media profile, or a seat in the cabinet. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's more where that came from in the article in the Wall Street Journal, and I fully recommend that if you have the time, you read it. It is online, and so go to today's edition of the Wall Street Journal and enjoy. Right, let me give you my information. It is, first of all, the toll-free number, which is gathering dust, as it seems not to be a function of our talks, but hey, never mind, I am always here to entertain, if not to inform. And the number that you might care to ring is 888-874-4888. Once again, the toll-free number here is 888-874-4888. If you would like to email me, as most people do who have things to say. You can email me at the email address, which is open throughout the entire show, and it is rm@gfawd.com. RM for me, Richard Martin, at GFAWD, Global Financial Advisory Wealth Design. .com. Once more, rm@gfawd.com. And finally, if you would like to call me directly, you may do so if you have matters of a private nature to discuss about your livelihood. You may call me on my direct line at the number which is in Sarasota, Florida, and takes you straight through to Singapore. Leave a message, rather a phone number and a name, if you would like me to call you back. I happen not to be at the phone. The number is 941, area code 441-1682. Again, 941-441-1682. All right. Well, today there are over 47 million Americans living in poverty, and that number is increasing every single month. Rather than sink even deeper into desperation, an increasing number of Americans are deciding to make a move. There are some areas of the United States that have become absolute hellholes. After years of experiencing intense economic frustration in those hellholes, many people are picking up stakes and are heading for greener pastures. Very few jobs are truly safe anymore. Years ago, when I first started the wake-up call here on PRIRN, people would ask me what kinds of job they should be looking for if or when they became unemployed, and I used to tell them to look into government jobs because they were relatively more secure. Well, unfortunately, and since quite a while now, that is no longer the case. Today, state and local government debt has reached at an all-time high of 22% of U.S. GDP. State and local governments from coast to coast are implementing austerity programs and are laying off employees at a staggering pace. For example, the state of California is basically a financial basket case at this point. I have several times discussed the whole hard reality that California is broke. Back in the 1960s and 70s, there was a seemingly endless parade of pop songs about how great life was in California, and millions of young Americans seemed moving to the land of sandy beaches and golden sunshine. But now all of that has changed. Today, millions of Californians are dreaming about leaving the state for good. The truth is that California is broke. The economy of the state is in shambles. The official unemployment rate has been sitting above 12% for an extended period of time, and poverty is everywhere. For many Californians today, there are very few reasons to stay in the state, but a whole lot of reasons to leave. Falling house prices, rising crime, budget cuts, rampant illegal immigration, horrific traffic, some of the most brutal tax rates in the nation, increasing gang violence and the ever-present threat of wildfires, mudslides, and natural disasters. It's easy to understand why there are now more Americans moving out of California each year than there are people moving into the state. California has become a complete and total disaster zone, and an increasing number of Californians are deciding that enough is enough, and they are getting out for good. Other desperate people are taking a different approach. Instead of moving to a new area, these people are coming up with creative ways of raising cash. For example, a criminal gang of white middle-aged women in Detroit, nicknamed the Mad Hatters, has become so successful that they have made international news. It is alleged that they have pulled off a stunning series of robberies. According to Britain's Daily Telegraph, the Mad Hatters have stolen somewhere in the neighborhood of $500,000 so far. The total value of merchandise and cash stolen could be as high as $500,000, according to police. The women stole almost $200,000 from one bank. Well, Tony McConnell drew my attention over the weekend to the new draconian requirements proposed for applications for an American passport. When I suggested that you should look for another country to emigrate to, it never occurred to me that the authorities might actively try to prevent you from doing so. It seems the time has come to address this. Among other things, the passport application form could contain the following requirement for information on mother's residence 1 year before, after, and during your birth. Mother's place of employment at your birth, whether she received pre- or postnatal care at the medical facility, the name of her doctor, and dates of her appointments, names, and contact info of those present at your birth, whether a religious ceremony was conducted at your birth. Other questions seem utterly irrelevant to establishing citizenship. For example, applicants are required to list the address of every place of residence since birth. They are required to list all schools attended and every instance of employment, including addresses, phone numbers, and names of supervisors. Presumably, if a 60-year-old applicant pumped gas at the age of 16, he would be required to track down the name of his supervisor. A question can all be left, of course, but the proposed form states, and I quote, "Failure to provide the information requested on this form may result in the denial of a United States passport, related documents, or service to the individual seeking such passport documents or service." End of quote. A particularly offensive section of DS 5513 requires information on family members, dead or living, including the applicant's mother, father, stepmother, stepfather, siblings, and children. The information includes their citizenship. An applicant can always lie, of course, for example, to protect a family member who may be an illegal immigrant, but the proposed form declares, and I quote, "False statements made knowingly and willfully in passport applications or in affidavits or other supporting documents submitted therewith are punishable by a fine and or imprisonment under the provisions of 18 U.S.C. 1001 and or 18 U.S.C. 1442. End of quote. Well, 18 U.S.C. 1001 punishes false statements to the government with a fine and up to 5 years imprisonment. If the offense involves terrorism, the imprisonment can be up to 8 years. 18 U.S.C. 1542 punishes false statements on passport applications with a fine and up to 25 years imprisonment. I leave it to you, my faithful listeners, to decide why you think the powers that be are motivated to obtain this outrageous and unwarranted information from you. You can get more information from informationliberation.com. That's all one word, informationliberation.com. Well, thanks again, Tony, for this. Very enlightening. And, ladies and gentlemen, it all goes to show why you'd better get hold of that passport PDQ and use it. All right. Well, what are we doing for time here? We've got 10 minutes, which is good, before our break. Getting American consumers back to their free spending ways is the fervent hope of just about every economy planner on the planet. The old shopping habits of these once thoroughly dependable mall people formed the very foundation on which broad Western prosperity and strong growth in China and the rest of the emerging world were built. But so far, the recovering shopaholics continue a distressing pattern of retrenchment, a trend undoubtedly intensified by plunging housing values and higher fuel and food costs. U.S. consumer spending rose only 2.7% in the first quarter, down sharply from 4% in the last 3 months of 2010, which is no trivial matter considering that the consumer accounts for about 70% of the U.S. economy, down from 71.3% of the pre-crisis peak. By the way, the Canadian level reached 64% last year, up from 56% in 2000. Wall Street economist Stephen Roach was saying the other day that the U.S. consumer share would continue shrinking until it returns to about the 66% level that prevailed for much of the last quarter of the 20th century, putting a big dent in GDP. He thinks we're only 20% of the way there. Annual growth in real U.S. consumption totaled close to 4% before the financial crisis struck in 2007. If the current trend continues, it will be closer to half that amount. Before the crisis, American consumption was soaring not because of income growth or rising employment, but because America was leveraging an asset bubble. The country extracted money from overvalued property, and that's over. Consumers are stuck with a legacy of excessive debt, inadequate saving, and facing high unemployment, higher underemployment, weak incomes, and holding on to assets that are underwater. No wonder Roach declares that, quote, the American consumer is toast. Higher exports and increased capital spending could help the U.S. economy weather the consumer's demoralizing decline. But I would say reduce your estimates of trend GDP growth in the U.S. over the next 3 to 5 years by at least 1 percentage point. That's a big deal. It certainly is, and it should. Hasn't been lost on China, which has embarked on an ambitious plan to change its economic model from one focused on export manufacturing geared to those U.S. shoppers to one centered on services and domestic Chinese consumption. According to Roach, and I quote, a post-crisis generation of zombie consumers in the U.S. is likely to hobble growth in global consumption for years to come. And that means that export-led developing Asia now has no choice but to turn inward and buy on its own 3.5 billion consumers. I think China gets it in terms of dealing with its imbalances. China will draw down surplus savings, its current account surplus, and slow its rate of foreign currency reserve accumulation and naturally reduce its demand for dollar-based assets. End of quote. But on the other side of the ledger, the United States will remain stuck with the world's largest current account deficit, the worst fiscal and economic outlook. Again, according to Roach, the debate in Washington tells me that we don't get it. We don't feel the pressure, the urgency to address our savings shortfall. The budget debate would be comical if it didn't have such tragic implications for the future of the United States. The outcome could be an asymmetrical rebalancing of the global economy, where the biggest surplus saver, China, moves in a credible way to boost internal private consumption, but the biggest deficit saver does very little. End of quote. Well, Roach's opinion on whether the economy will return officially to recession, and I quote, I'm not prepared to turn in my stripes as a card-carrying double dipper. The lessons of centuries and centuries of financial history make it very clear that post-crisis recoveries are weak. When weak for a long period of time, they lack the cushion that economies normally need to withstand the blows of a shock. So I don't think you can rule it out. All right, ladies and gentlemen, here we are. It is nearly time for our little break. So let me just take one or maybe two emails that I've received during the weekend. One comes from Henry E., who says, I've been to Japan several times, and I can personally attest to the fact that the people there have been demoralized by the last two decades. The sense of forward movement that was common in Japan two decades ago has been replaced by a sense of lowered expectations and insecurity. In the U.S., I remember this demoralization in the early 1990s, with that weak economy and high crime levels. But then the late 1990s boom time came and all that was forgotten. And even the early 2000s recession and 9/11 couldn't shake the optimism. But now the sense that things are going downhill seems to be back in the U.S., especially among the middle class. Money class is doing fine. I live in San Diego and observed a very interesting phenomenon recently in the local real estate market. It looks like in early 2011, one or more banks sent out a small flood of properties on the market. And these properties sat there for a while and got a few price cuts as it became apparent that the demand was just not there. Eventually, most of those properties have disappeared, presumably sold or maybe delisted. And since then, nothing, I mean virtually nothing, has hit the market recently. I assume that potential sellers and the banks saw what happened and have decided not to shake loose any more shadow inventory. Anyone know if my assumption is correct or what's going on? Henry E. Well, I maintain that the unemployment rate is at least double the 9% reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Unfortunately, the reasoning required to get to that argument is really quite complicated. It deals with how the government comes to their conclusions, and I think it is purposefully abstruse. You know, somewhat like car dealerships which price cars differently from each other to make it very difficult, if not impossible, for you to compare prices. Logically, one might think one would be unemployed if they want a job and do not have a job. However, for the government, it doesn't quite work like that. The official definition of unemployed is you do not have a job, you want a job, and crucially, you have looked for a job in the last 4 weeks. Every month the government reports alternative numbers, but even though many of the alternative numbers are a more accurate representation of the unemployment rate, the media focuses on the headline number, ignoring millions who have, quote, dropped out of the labor force simply because they stopped looking for work. Millions more are in forced retirement, which I define as someone over 60 whose unemployment benefits ran out, so they retired to collect Social Security even though they really would like a job. Ilagi at Automatic Earth, in a blog entitled Trojan Lies, comments as follows, and I quote, indeed, I'd venture that if you add in all those who've left the workforce since 2008, you'd end up way above 11%. All in all, the total number of people in the working age population who are not in the labor force hit a new all-time high of 86.248 million in April. And Wall Street likes that. End of quote. As I said, this entire concept is quite complicated, so if you're interested, you should read a blog entry of Mike Shedlock's entitled Digging Still Deeper in Friday's Jobs Report. And you can find that at globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com. It explains the conundrum in full, and quite frankly, ladies and gentlemen, it is worth your time. Let me give you that website again in case some of you have been frantically grabbing pen and paper. The name of the blogger is Mike Shedlock, that I've mentioned many times. I think he is one of the best commentators on the financial world today, and I read what he says avidly. I believe the man is very talented at bringing this kind of information to us. Again, his name is Mike Shedlock, and the website you want to go to get the information is Global Economic Analysis, and that's all one word, blogspot.com. Once more, globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com. And the article is entitled Digging Still Deeper in Friday's Jobs Report. And that should come up pretty quickly as you scroll down, because it's a very recent article written either today, this morning, or else yesterday. So it's right up at the top of the pile there. Digging Still Deeper in Friday's Jobs Report. And it really does give you a very good, it's quite a long article, but it's worth spending a few minutes, because it's one of the clearer accounts of the very complicated nature of how the American government manages to bring what I personally, along with John Williams of ShadowStats.com, believe to be a 20%+ rate of unemployment down to 9%. It takes quite a lot of ingenuity to do that, in my opinion, and the government does it very well. The government was only able to do everything else it does as well as to lie about the statistics. Life would be really worth living, and you would all come back and enjoy yourselves in the United States. But as things are right now, let's take a break from me and get to some of our promos. So with that, I shall be right back.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off! I said not to play it!
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny!
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the mama grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Join us, Bruce and Marianne Curtis, Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network for Truth and Freedom. We present provocative conversations with the world's most brilliant minds in the areas of holistic health, spiritual wisdom, politics, and a host of other topics. Some of our topics include the latest work in non-invasive therapy on the brain, the truth beneath the global economic meltdown, healing power of the breath, and the sublime truth beyond all religious traditions. In this age of transformation, we need to look beneath the surface appearance of things to see the underlying reality. From material that is always illuminating and often liberating, tune in to Truth and Freedom on the Progressive Radio Network, Fridays at 3 p.m.
Do you want to listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
South of the border.
Are you one of the millions caught up in that first world rat race? Well, I used to be. I'm John Mueller, host of the Expat Files, where we discuss what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire down in Latin America. Can you really live like a king down here on a crummy Social Security check? What about starting a business or buying a house or love and romance? Just tune in Monday and Wednesday at 8 p.m. and send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And to listen to any of my past shows, just go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives and click on the link to the Expat Files. Nos vemos.
I kissed a smile upon her face.
Hello, this is Sandra B. Tay from Success Power Talk. You can listen live to me every Saturday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for the very best success strategies for your life, bringing you sumptuous, exciting topics, expert guests, and panelists from all over. You will not want to miss. Email me at coach@tateworks.com if you have questions you want read on the air. If you missed any past shows, go to progressiveradionetwork.com/archives to find them. Always take the best and leave the rest. Success Power Talks, every Saturday, 4 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
To the Progressive Radio Network, celebrating 5 years of independent points of view.
Okay, we're back, and I promised you on Friday that I would talk a little bit about the differences between the German way of doing things and that which prevails in the United States. Well, it may not come as a surprise to you, ladies and gentlemen, in many measures the vast majority live better in Germany than in America. And to achieve this, German workers on average pay 52% of their income in taxes. Americans average 30%, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. At first blush, the German tax burden seems horrendous. In Germany, as well as in Britain, France, Scandinavia, Canada, Australia, and Japan, tax-supported institutions provide many of the things Americans pay for with after-tax dollars. Buying wholesale rather than retail saves money. Corporate profits were up 12%, from $1.6 billion in 2007 to $1.8 billion in 2008. But corporate income tax revenues fell to $230 billion from $249 billion, thanks to loopholes. A proper comparison would take the 30% average tax of American workers and add the out-of-pocket spending on healthcare, college tuition, and fees for services, and compare that with taxes that the average German pays. Add it all up, and the combination of tax and personal spending is roughly equal in both countries, but with a large risk of catastrophic loss in America and a tiny risk in Germany. Americans take on $85 billion of debt each year for higher education, while college is financed by taxes in Germany and tuition is cheap to free in other modern countries. While soaring medical costs are a key reason that since 1980 bankruptcy in America has increased 15 times faster than population growth, no one in Germany or the rest of the modern world goes broke because of accident or illness. And child poverty in America is the highest among modern countries, almost twice the rate in Germany, which is close to the average of modern countries. On the corporate tax side, the Germans encourage reinvestment at home and the outsourcing of low-value work like auto assembly, and German rules tightly control accounting so that profits earned at home cannot be made to appear as profits earned in tax havens. Adopting the German system is not the answer for America, but crafting a tax system that benefits the vast majority reduces risks provides universal health care and focuses on diplomacy rather than militarism abroad and at home, would be a lot smarter than what they have now. Here is a question to ask yourself. America started down this road with Reagan's election in 1980 and upped the ante in this century with George W. Bush. How long does it take to conclude that a policy has failed to fulfill its promises? As you think about that, keep in mind George Washington. When he fell ill, his doctors followed the common wisdom of the era. They cut him and bled him to remove bad blood. As Washington's condition grew worse, they bled him more. And, like the mantra of tax cuts for the rich, they kept applying the same treatment until they killed him. Well, luckily, we don't bleed the sick anymore. But America is bleeding its government to death. Well, it appears that the damnable Fed is responsible for the biggest flib and flam in the nation's history. But thanks to the Congressional Research Service, the scam has been exposed and the public can now get a good look at the type of swindle that passes as monetary policy. Here's the scoop. When Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke initiated the first round of quantitative easing, the stated goal was to revive the flagging housing market by purchasing $1.25 trillion in mortgage-backed securities from the country's biggest banks. The policy was a rip-off from the get-go. No one wanted these mortgage stink bombs that were stitched together from subprime loans to unqualified applicants. But because the banks were already bust, and because the $700 billion TARP was barely enough to keep the ventilator running until the next bailout came through, the Fed helped to conceal its real objectives behind an elaborate PR smokescreen. In truth, the Fed must have colluded with the banks to move the toxic assets off their books and onto the Fed's balance sheet, with the proviso that the banks withhold foreclosed homes from the market. By keeping the extra homes off market, supply went down, demand went up slightly, and housing showed signs of a rebound. The withholding of supply was synchronized with the first-time home buyers credit, which provided an $8,000 subsidy to new home buyers. This pumped up housing sales and further concealed what was really taking place, which was a gigantic transfer of public wealth to the banks in exchange for putrid assets that nobody wanted. Naturally, the process kept the market from correcting and added vast numbers of foreclosed homes to the shadow inventory. During this same period, the Fed worked out an agreement with Congress to pay the banks interest on the reserves it created at the banks. Note, the MBS were exchanged for reserves. At the time, many experts questioned the wisdom of the Fed's plan, saying that the reserves would not lead to another credit expansion. And they were right, too. In fact, it didn't stop the slide in housing either, which resumed with gusto as soon as QE ended and the banks started dumping more foreclosed homes onto the market. So why would the Fed add more than $1 trillion in reserves to the banking system if it really served no earthly purpose? Was it just so the banks would be able to earn interest on those reserves? Surely, that wouldn't be nearly enough to remove the ocean of red ink on their balance sheets. So what was Bernanke really up to? On Tuesday last, Senator Bernie Sanders' office released a CRS report entitled "Banks Play Shell Game with Taxpayers' Dollars" that sheds a bit of light on the shady ways the Fed conducts its business. Sanders, quote, found numerous instances during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009 when banks took near zero interest rate funds from the Federal Reserve and then loan the money back to the federal government on safe harbor for the banks. End of quote. So now we have irrefutable proof that the Fed was simply handing out money to the banks. More importantly, the report shows that this was not just a few isolated incidents, but patterns of abuse that increased as the needs of the banks became more pressing. In other words, giving away money became policy. Is it any wonder why the Fed has fought so ferociously to prevent an audit of its books? From Sanders' report, and I quote, the banks pocketed interest on government securities that paid rates up to 12 times greater than the Fed's rock-bottom interest charges, according to a Congressional Research Service analysis conducted for Sanders. Are you kidding me? 12 times more than what the Fed was getting in return? That's larceny. Grand larceny. More from the Sanders report, and I quote, this report confirms that ultra-low interest rates provided by the Federal Reserve during the financial crisis turned out to be direct corporate welfare to big banks. Instead of using the Fed loans to reinvest in the economy, some of the largest financial institutions in this country appear to have lent this money back to the federal government at a higher rate of interest by purchasing U.S. government securities. End of quote. And they didn't lend back to Uncle Sam at a hefty rate of interest. They plunked into equities to ignite Bernanke's stock market blast-off, the final phase of bubble mania. So let's use an analogy to explain what the Fed was doing. Imagine that you provide your son Kirby with a weekly allowance of $50. And Kirby, showing an uncanny aptitude for career banking, says, Dad, I'd like to loan this money back to you at 10% per annum. Would that be a good deal for you, Dad? Or would dearest Kirby be taking you to the cleaners? That's what Bernanke was doing. At rates up to 12 times greater than the Fed's rock-bottom interest charges. So the question is, if Bernanke was already involved in this type of hanky-panky, what would keep him from raising the stakes a bit and really putting his friends back in the clover? Honor? Integrity? Not likely. What I'd like to know is whether the Fed has been creating reserves at the banks, reserves that the banks have then converted into government bonds and sold back to the Fed during QE2. In other words, is this another circular trade, like we see in the Sanders report, whose only purpose is to funnel more money to the banks? And if that's not the case, then where did the banks come up with $600 billion in U.S. treasuries that they just sold to the Fed? After all, in fact, before the Fed Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC, Bernanke admitted that 12 of the 13 biggest banks in the country were underwater after Lehman Brothers defaulted. If that's true, then where did they get the $600 billion in treasuries? It's not a question of whether the Fed has been abusing its power. It's just a matter of how much. Wow. The mind boggles. Just boggles. Well, according to Carl Denninger, the government is now trying to find ways to track how far you drive so that they can tax you according to the distance you have traveled. Apart from the logistical impossibility of doing this, the privacy issues involved are monumental. Ladies and gentlemen, this is nothing less than the furtherance of the police state under which they want you all to live. It's too crazy even to contemplate, but unfortunately you are going to have to, or leave. And I'm sure you'd know which alternative I would select. Well, when home prices were rising rapidly during the bubble years of 2003-06, it was almost inconceivable that a homeowner would voluntarily stop making payments on the mortgage and lapse into default while having the financial means to remain current on the loan. Those major metros where prices soared the most during the housing bubble, homeowners who have strategically defaulted share three essential assumptions. The value of their home would not recover to their original purchase price for quite a few years. They could rent a house similar to theirs for considerably less than what they were paying on the mortgage. They could suck away tens of thousands of dollars by stopping mortgage payments before the lender finally got around to foreclosing. Put yourself into the mind and shoes of an underwater homeowner who held these three assumptions. Can you see how the temptation to default might be difficult to resist? By September 2009, an astounding 80% of all these homeowners in California, Florida, Nevada, and Arizona had defaulted. The percentage of defaults which are strategic rises steadily as negative equity increases. For example, with FICO scores between 660 and 720, roughly 45% of defaults are strategic when the mortgage amount is 50% more than the value of the home. When the loan is 70% more than the house's value, 60% of the defaults were strategic. When the mortgage exceeds the home value by 60%, roughly 55% of the defaults are considered to be strategic. For those strategic defaulters who are this far underwater, the benefits of stopping the mortgage payment outweigh the drawbacks, or costs, as the authors portray it, enough to overcome whatever reservations they might outweigh the drawbacks, or When the loan is 70% more than the house's value, 60% of the defaults were strategic. When the mortgage exceeds the home value by 60%, roughly 55% of the defaults are considered to be strategic. For those strategic defaulters who are this far underwater, the benefits of stopping the mortgage payment outweigh the drawbacks enough to overcome whatever reservations they might have about walking away. The implications of this are really grim. Keep in mind that 80% of the 133,000 no-down payment loans examined had gone into default within 3 years. Clearly, homeowners with no skin in the game have little incentive to continue paying the loan when the property goes further and further underwater. Here is the most ominous statistic of them all. In early September, there were roughly 13 million HELOCs outstanding, that's home equity loans, of credit. This HELOC madness was concentrated in California, where more than 2.3 million were originated in 2005 to 2006 alone. How many of these homes with HELOCs are underwater today? Roughly 98% of them, and maybe more. Equifax reported that in July 2009, the average HELOC balance nationwide for homeowners with prime first mortgages was nearly $125,000. Yet the studies which discuss how many homeowners are underwater have examined only first liens. It's very difficult to get good data about second liens on a property. So if you've read that roughly 25% of all homes with a mortgage are now underwater, forget that number. If you include all second liens, it could easily be 50%. This means that in many of those major metros that have experienced the worst price collapse, more than 50% of all mortgaged properties may be seriously underwater. Nowhere is the impact of the collapse in home prices more evident than in Florida. The three counties with the highest percentage of first liens either seriously delinquent or in pre-foreclosure, default, are all located in Florida. According to CoreLogic, the worst county is Miami-Dade, with an incredible 25% of all mortgages in serious distress and headed for either foreclosure or short sale. An article posted on the Huffington Post in mid-January 2011 describes the Florida mortgage meltdown in grim detail. Written by Floridian Mark Sunshine, it begins by pointing out that 50% of all the residential mortgages currently sitting in private, non-GSE mortgage-backed securities were more than 60 days delinquent, either seriously delinquent, in default, bankruptcy, or already foreclosed by the bank. I checked his source, the American Securitization Forum, and the percentage was correct. The author then goes on to discuss a strategic default situation among his friends in Florida. One of them had purchased a condo in early 2007 for $300,000. By mid-2010, it had plunged in value to less than $100,000, and he decided to stop paying the mortgage. When he expressed his concerns about the possible consequences to his buddies, including an attorney, an accountant, and a doctor, all expressed the same advice to him. They told him to walk away from the mortgage, save his money, and prepare to move to a rental unit. To them, it seemed like a no-brainer. The author was a little surprised that no one thought there was anything wrong with strategically defaulting. The attorney actually suggested that the defaulter file for bankruptcy to prevent the bank from going after a deficiency judgment for the remaining loan balance after the repossessed property was sold. The conclusion expressed by the author has far-reaching implications. As he saw it, and I quote, "More and more Floridians who pay their mortgage feel like chumps compared to defaulters. They tell their disposable income to the bank and know it will take most of their lifetimes to recover." End of quote. As prices slide to new lows in metro after metro, will this attitude towards defaulting spread from Florida to more and more of the nation? A May 2010 Money magazine survey asked readers if they would ever consider walking away from their mortgage. The results were sobering indeed. Never, 42%. Only if I had to, 38%. Yes, 16%. Already have, 4%. In late January of year, a report on strategic defaults issued by the Nevada Association of Realtors seemed to confirm the findings of the two studies I've discussed. The telephone survey interviewed 1,000 Nevada homeowners. One question asked was this: some homeowners in Nevada have chosen to undergo a strategic default and stop making mortgage payments despite having the ability to make the payments. Some refer to this as walking away from a mortgage. Would you describe your current or recent situation as a strategic default? Of those surveyed, 23% said they would classify their own situation as a strategic default. Many of those surveyed said that trusted confidants had advised them that strategic default was their best option. One typical response was that the loan, quote, was so upside down it would never have been okay, end of quote. What seems fairly certain from this Nevada survey and the two reports I've reviewed is that as home values continue to decline and loan-to-value ratios rise, the number of homeowners choosing to walk away from their mortgage obligation will grow relentlessly. That means growing trouble for nearly all major housing markets around the country. Pretty self-explanatory, I would say, ladies and gentlemen. All right. Well, I thought I had a question, which I do. So I'm going to end with a question that came in from Tom Polasek, who says, "Hi, Richard. I just started listening online, and I have some questions. What's the toughest thing about being an expat in Singapore?" Well, funny you should ask that question, Tom, my wife, and I were discussing that just today. I think the toughest thing about an expat in Singapore is trying to convince other people to do the same thing. Well, I don't know, quite frankly. There's nothing very tough about it. We just had our elections, and the ruling party continues to rule, one that's been ruling since 1959, although with a severely decreased majority. But it's still ruling, so stability reigns. Next question. If you were the head of the Bank of China, when would you cut off buying stateside debt? Well, I think they already have, Tom. My impression is that they're not buying stateside debt anymore. They're not selling what they already have, but they're turning their attention elsewhere, and well, they might. The question really should have been, when will they start redeeming the debt they do have? Anyway, I shall leave you to ask that question, and I shall dodge it, because we just have time for the third question. All right. Since the dollar is still the standard for much of the global economy, what advantage would you have by selling this? I can't see one. Am I missing something, Tom? Well, the dollar is still the standard of the global economy. The advantage that you would have had by selling this several months ago or several years ago, Tom, is that you might have 30% more money in your bank account. But in default of that, assuming that you haven't already sold your dollars, I would hang on to them. I think that there will be a stiff rally in the dollar, and I said this a few weeks ago, and indeed it appears to have already begun. And that rally is really predicated on the fact that when you are the reserve currency, many countries will use your currency in order to make debts with each other and with the mother country. And I think that many of these debts, along with a credit, which are going to become due, and people are going to scramble for dollars to pay these debts. And therefore, I think, contrary to the opinion of many pundits, your dollars will retain value and, in fact, increase in value. So for those who may be going away this summer, or for those who have dollars and are thinking of buying other currencies, for the time being, don't. That is my advice. I think your dollar will increase quite substantially in value over the next few months. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the end of Monday's session with the Wake Up Call. I have enjoyed talking to you, and I wish you a wonderful week. I will be back on Friday for the next talk in the series. So with that, I wish you well. Bye-bye. See you soon.